I'm sitting at my desk and I see commotion heading towards the recess bay. I hear overhead, level one pediatric trauma, ETA, here now. I get up and I go into the room and I see a sea of people coming in, putting the yellow gowns on, and a child in the middle of it. It's an 8-year-old girl who's been kicked by a horse, is unresponsive. The question is, in 45 minutes when the helicopter leaves, taking this kid away, how do you want to feel? Time is not linear, and these 10 seconds of organization are worth so much more than the next 3 minutes of disorganization would be. Let's not believe that every second is worth the same.
That is the voice of today's guest, Dr. Lon Setnick. And you are listening to the Stimulus Podcast. Hello, my friends. How you doing? I hope you're well. For those of you new to the show, my name is Rob Orman. I spent 20 years as an emergency physician and am now a physician coach. My mission is to help docs get unstuck, unburnt, and kick ass in their careers and lives. And this is my pod, where we talk about the ways to do that. So welcome. I'm glad you came. Our guest today is Lon Setnick, MD, a stimulus favorite, a Rob Orman favorite. He's been our guest so many times, most recently on episode 100, Listening to Understand versus Listening to Win. Check it out if you haven't already. Lon is an emergency physician practicing in New Hampshire and is the Associate Director of Clinical Programs at the Center for Medical Simulation. That is like being the Associate Director at NASA for Dr. Brains. I always look forward to learning from Lon and hearing his dulcet tones on the airwaves. Lon, such a treat.
Great to see you, Rob.
What we're going to talk about today grew from a recent episode on zero warning patients that we had with Scott Weingart. What do you do when a critical event lands at your feet with no notice? And in that conversation, we examine how to break down the logistics and strategies of these zero warning situations. But what did we not talk about? We didn't discuss the fact that you almost never respond to a zero warning or crisis situation by yourself. But if you don't have time to organize your team beforehand, how do you do it when you are immediately slung into action managing the crisis itself, right? You got to do the thing and organize your team. How do you create that something out of nothing when you are just plopped into the storm? We're going to find out in just a moment, but first, this bit of loveliness. Hey friends, Awake and Aware, our live event in Bend, Oregon, May 1st through 3rd, 2024, is right around the corner. I mean, it may have already gone around the corner depending on when you listen to this, but if you listen to this fresh when it drops, it's coming up in about a month. There are only a few slots left. We have intentionally kept this small. So if you're interested and want one of those slots, now's the time to jump in. The link to the Awake and Aware website where you can learn more and register is in the show notes for this episode. And I've been thinking about this of late that for the past many months, I've been promoting this workshop on this show, and that is where the bulk of the promotion has happened on Stimulus. So in some ways, this is going to be a Stimulus community event, which I'm so incredibly excited about. And if you're interested in learning and working through tools to recalibrate your mindset and make it stick, to mitigate stress and stay calm under pressure, hanging out with some really cool folks who are also interested in elevating their lives and careers, and earn 16.25 hours of CME while you're doing it, this is the place where all that happens. Very tangentially related to that, I'm going to take a break from Stimulus for the next month or two, and I'll be back in May or June, unless I see you in person at Awake and Aware. Either way, much love. Let's get into this show. So, Lon, let's take this zero warning situation as our starting point. You've got what you, I guess you could call an ad hoc team that's facing a crisis. It's not even an ad hoc team yet. You want to create an ad hoc team. So they're doing a task that they don't do every day, or it could even be a regular team that works together all the time, but they're not structured. They're not put into place. There's not the communication amongst the team to prepare or even a little bit of setup. So what needs to happen to congeal this group of people, to create that something out of nothing?
Rob, this is such an important question. And it can really be an issue of a crisis with no warning or a crisis that emerges while we're caring for a patient. And the arc of that can be slow. So it can be really rapid as well. I think that we need a framework that can help us to identify that we're in a moment where we need to take action and organize a team. We need to identify the problem that we're facing, even when there's uncertainty about what the problem is. We need to claim the leadership role that we're going to take and get the team organized. And then we need to connect people with the tasks that need to be done. And we need to do it in an efficient way, in a reproducible way that we can call upon in the most difficult moments of our careers. This is one of the things we've been working on at the Center for Medical Simulation for really the last 30 years. I think what we want to talk about today is how do we rapidly, effectively, and reproducibly organize a team in the moment to make the most of our most challenging situations.
You're talking about this naming, this claiming, this aiming. How does that actually work?
We're getting right down into the nitty-gritty. I'm wondering if it would make sense to tell a quick story, show the model, say the model, and then start to break it down a little bit.
Let's do it. Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that is a topic that should be a through line in this whole conversation is the tension that we feel between planning and action. When we're in the moment where action needs to take place, and actually we're comforted by taking action as high performers who are really good at our skills, it's very comfortable to take action. However, when we neglect the planning part, we don't function as effectively as we need to.
Let me back that up even a little bit more. You're talking about planning this, but the most important part of any pathway is the entry criteria. How do you know when you're in a crisis situation and that you need to deploy this technique?
There isn't really one specific definition that you can use. A lot of what people will describe is the speed of change of the situation is faster than your team can accommodate to. So number one is, how quickly are things happening? Number two is, what are the resources that you have to try to address the problem? So a crisis can also be defined by a gap between the resources and the needs. Finally, what are the skills within the team or the system that you can deploy? Anytime there's a gap between your ability to respond and the needs of the situation, that's a crisis. The question is, how do you know when you're in a crisis? And I think we all develop these internal techniques. I used to say, I'm going to build critical care if you make me sweat. And one of the first ways I know I'm in a crisis personally is, wow, I notice that I'm sweating. Other things that people will notice is the room is too loud. There's a lot of people in the room. And it's funny, if you find that patient in cardiac arrest, you push the code bell and start doing compressions, in a few moments, you're going to look up. There's going to be a lot of people in the room. And that can be a really important trigger that you need to pull out your framework to get this team organized. Another one is, you're in a resuscitation and it's really loud. That's a key moment. It's a key indicator that this team needs to get organized. And finally, an abrupt change in clinical status should prompt you looking around and trying to get your team organized. There's probably others, but you've had a career. How did you know that you needed to try to organize a group that you're working with?
So a couple things come up as you're saying that. I think we had an episode on active violence situations, active shooter, active, all these things with a doc who was, he had been a Green Beret and now an emergency physician, very storied career, and talking about how to respond and all this. And it's like, how do you know when you're actually in one of these situations? And he said, I can't remember exactly what he said, but basically, because you're a human being, and this is one of the core functions of your brain, this is pure limbic, fight, fright, freeze, and there's some attunement to that. I think that if you are day one, medical student walking into the ICU, you really don't know the difference between, oh, is this a crisis? It's not a crisis. But once you're attuned, and I'm just thinking this extemporaneously, once you're attuned to what preparation feels like, then you know what unprepared feels like. Unprepared and high risk, or unprepared and rapidly developing. Because if you have a patient with acute otitis media that gets thrown into room six, that's not a crisis. Okay, we have our time. But I'm thinking about a situation where my partner Rosie and I were working together. The ambulance bay doors open up and there's a car with a lifeless body in the passenger seat. He just died. It's just the two of us. We're usually the shot callers. And so Rosie and I pulled this guy out and pulled him into resus bay one. So we started CPR. We got out the defibrillator and it's like, where's all our freaking people? And that was a crisis. It was that inner sense of unprepared. And for me, what I picture is like my shoelaces are tied together. And that to me says, yeah, it's time that you actually need a framework to do this, because the natural ways that you organize your team are not going to work.
Yeah, I love that. I think what I'm hearing is you developed a sense for when you had an organizational scheme in your head for the moment, because you'd practiced it, and when it was something that had deviated from that, and your mind had lost its organization, and that was a trigger for you to, okay, I need to reel it in. And if you have a tool that you can apply in that moment that you can fall back on, then that decreases your cognitive load, it decreases your stress level, and it helps you reorganize and reengage.
As you're saying that, I think you and I have probably taken care of hundreds of penetrating trauma patients, gunshot wounds. And yeah, you really all kind of blend into one another. But I don't know about you, but I remember every drop-off, every drive-by is kind of, because it's a little bit traumatic for you. It's a crisis. It's chaos. It is those situations, ones that you're going to remember afterwards, because yeah, we don't have our Formula One pit crew to do that 2-second wheel change. It's we got to go buy the tires.
No, I think you're pointing out something really important about teams and how they work is they are so contextual in their skill set. There are hospitals in the world where drop-off shootings are so common that they're actually relatively routine. And when that happens at the hospitals I work at, thankfully they're quite rare, but it is, those are the most difficult moments, and that's what we need these tools for.
So you were about to tell a story to put this in context, this name, claim, aim. How do we start to slow this down and think about it as we're going to build it into a practice, a pattern?
All right, let's start the story to just get people thinking about this key challenge in our healthcare teams, and that is organizing a team in the middle of a crisis. This is not an exact reproduction of a situation I was in, but it is very close. And it was a Sunday afternoon, a routine Sunday at the regional referral trauma center I work at, which is about 50,000 visits. And it's an adult trauma center. I'm sitting at my desk and I see commotion heading towards the resus bay. I hear overhead, level one pediatric trauma, ETA here now. I get up and I go into the room and I see a sea of people coming in, putting the yellow gowns on, and a child in the middle of it. It's an 8-year-old girl who's been kicked by a horse, is unresponsive, is brought in by her family and went unresponsive en route. I see the surgeon come in and it's a Sunday. It's our minimally invasive surgeon. And they have told me before, I don't do kids. We're a regional center, so we don't have in-house acute care pediatric surgeons. I see the pediatrician come in. She is a fantastic pediatrician, specializes in newborn resuscitation. An 8-year-old I know is not in her wheelhouse. And the anesthesiologist comes in who I have never met before. I also look up and I have Hannah and in that moment, I'm trying to remember, I know Hannah's a tech, but she's in nursing school. Is she a nurse or a tech right now? So who is this team? I start to get a dry mouth and that anxious feeling that you were talking about, which is, how do I get the most out of this team so that in our most difficult moment, and this is one of those pediatric level one trauma drop off at a community hospital, that's going to be one of the most difficult moments of your career. The question is, in 45 minutes when the helicopter leaves, taking this kid away, how do you want to feel? Do you want to feel exalted, like you brought the team together and the family saw a fantastic resuscitation that was calm? Or are you going to feel let down in some way? Are you going to feel like you weren't able to rise to the occasion when your community and the people around you needed it? Uncertain about your team and what they can provide. And a lot of that rests on our ability to just get organized as a team. So you say, okay, everyone, we have an 8-year-old kicked by a horse with at least a head injury, possibly other injuries. She's unstable. She's getting bagged. We're all going to need to be our best. I'm going to work with Dr. Cohen, the surgeon, to get us organized. I'll need all of your help, okay? We need to keep the noise in the room down. We need to close loop on communication. We need to be clear about our roles and speak up if there's anything we're struggling with. All right, let's get to ABCs. Dr. Marks, you take over on bagging, anesthesia. Check before you intubate. We're going to need to make sure we don't need to resuscitate before you're intubating. Hannah and the techs, IVs and vitals. Are you guys good with that? And Dr. Cohen, as surgeon, let's do airway breathing circulation. You're going to help make decisions. Are we going to the OR? Are we going to CT? Are we transferring? Dr. Aziz, pediatrics, I need your help with family, talking to them. And if we need dosing assistance on emergency meds, can you help us with that? So that's what I'm thinking is going on. What am I missing, everybody? I need your help. So that is name, claim, aim. I'm going to break it down really quickly. First, we need to identify it's a moment that we need to pull out our tool, as you talked about. Second, name the situation. Now, as Scott said in the zero notice drop-off case, a lot of times, and in all of our resuscitations, there can be a lot of uncertainty, and naming that uncertainty connected to with what we do know is really helpful. We need to have some humility about what we do and don't know. And when we don't know what's happening, saying that as part of the naming is critical. Claiming your role as the leader or organizer with an explicit request for everybody's help. So I'm going to claim my role. I'm going to get us organized and I'm going to need all of your help. Okay. And that okay demands a closing of the loop. So you want people to respond in the affirmative and not ignore you. And aim, you're aiming the team. So you're describing the big picture, where we're headed and who's going to do what. And that has associated with it an explicit request for input. So I finished with the statement, what am I missing? What else should we be doing? That is a call for everybody to participate in the thinking that needs to take place. I'm going to pause there. Love to hear your thoughts.
So many. I have a small thought and then a big thought. I'm going to start with a small one. So I think that first part of we have a problem. Here's what's going on. I think it's this. Let's just name the situation. It reminds me of emergency empathy from nonviolent communication, where you name what you think that other person's emotion is, or what their feeling is, and what their need is. And you might be totally wrong, but it shifts the focus of the conversation onto that thing rather than, hey, we're all crap in our pants. It's, oh, here's a problem. We all need to deal with it. Organization is happening. I love that. The claim, there's a part of this. And I'm curious what you do when it doesn't go well. And I want to ask a couple not go well questions. I'm claiming the role of team leader. And I'm going to be organizing everyone in here. I need your help. Okay? You say that okay, and you get silence. Everybody's still just processing things. How do you snap them into focus? First off, how does the sequence work? And then what do you do when there is invariably no response?
Yeah, so the sequence is I'm taking the bold move of declaring myself as an organizer. And the word that you use is it can be context dependent. Throughout this whole thing, I'm going to give a script, and it is not what each person should say. They're going to need to find their own version of this, but it's a framework that people can start to experiment with. My observation in the emergency department is that we are used to team leader, a physician identifying themselves as a team leader. We think that is how the world works. Same is true for like a code on the floor. It's very common that somebody will say, I'm the team leader, I'm leading this team. In the operating room, it works differently. The anesthesiologists are a very flat hierarchy. When they call for anesthesia stat, they get more anesthesiologists who are the same. So they don't really feel often comfortable using the word leader. They feel more comfortable in our experience using the word organizer. There's room to play there. Let's say you are an intern. A lot of times interns won't feel comfortable saying, I'm going to lead this team. They'll feel more comfortable saying something like, I'm going to get us organized until the senior shows up. All of these are fine. The key is declaring some form of structure to the team, and you're the brave person to take the first step. That also does something for yourself, though. If you say, I'm going to lead this team, I'm going to get us organized, it shifts some of your focus and attention onto the function and assignment of roles, who's doing what, and paying attention to how the team is functioning. So I think it's equally important for yourself to say those words, so that you start to identify yourself as having the role of leading and organizing this team.
I was just trying to pay attention to the valence of my reaction to these different words. So leader is, oh boy, it's all on me. Organizer, the word I wrote down was inert. That is an inert term of, hey man, just HR here. Everybody take your roles. Doing great, baby. Doing great. I'm going to get us organized. I like that scripting. I'm going to get us organized and talk about roles. As I say that, I'm even getting more passive. I'm going to get us organized and assign roles. I think it definitely takes a feel of the room and who's in there. But what is the point that you ask for that response back? And what do you do when you don't get it?
And I'll add one more scripting that people will use is the word event manager is one that people will use as well.
I think of somebody putting on a conference. Right?
That's where you go. In big, chaotic, multi-casualty situations, that can be a really good phrase to use. Mm-hmm. Or in certain contexts. I claim my role. I actually want to do it with permission of the team, explicit permission of the team. So I ask for that permission right away. So I'm going to lead this team. I'm going to work on getting us organized. Okay. You're right. The normal response is none, silence. And so I say it again. So, okay. And then people will respond. And I think that's really important. So if we allow the silence to occur, what we're doing is we are modeling not closing the loop. That as the team lead, it is okay to not close the loop. And closing the loop is a little bit awkward. We don't do it in our everyday lives. When we have normal conversations, we don't normally do this with our family and our friends. And yes, I will go get two beers, right? We don't do that. It's awkward. So what we need to do is take that first role of being a leader, of demanding a communication process that is really important for the success of our team. And that's closing the loop. So you will get silence and you need to overcome it with ensuring that people are closing the loop. And that involves saying, usually for me, that involves saying okay again with eye contact and with a pause where I'm expecting them to say something back to me.
All right, here's what I wrote down as you're saying that is the okay can mean so many things. It's not the direct request. You know, here's my need. I'm going to get us organized and I need your help. Okay. Silence. I'm going to need to hear your voices. I'm going to need your help. Mm. Okay.
I like
and
that.
And this is all about clarity. Hey, we've got a problem. I think it's this. I'm going to be the organizer. I need your help. Okay. Okay is, oh yeah, I'm fine with you being the organizer. But really, it's the okay is I'm about to receive roles. And I think being super explicit there the more transparent, the better. And it is awkward. We want to be liked and we don't want to be bossy. And it's a fine line between being talked about in the break room as a overbearing tyrant versus, wow, what an organizer.
Okay, so you're bringing up such a fantastic key part of this, which is riding the balance between being a forceful leader who moves the team in a specific direction and not unintentionally suppressing speaking up behaviors. So if you're too over the top with your, I'm using my air quotes, your leaderliness, you can unintentionally suppress speaking up behaviors. So that is why we have in here the explicit initial request for response with the okay. And at the end of name, claim, aim, there is a second explicit request for people speaking up. And that helps to balance the forceful organizing, which needs to happen at the beginning of a code. So there is research that in the first 3 minutes of a code, of a resuscitation team response, you need more forceful leadership to overcome the chaos that starts every situation. And so we need to start with a fairly strong tone, but we have to balance that with explicit requests for speaking up so that people don't have their observations and their perspectives silenced, because we really need them to speak up for the rest of the resuscitation.
Hey friends, if you haven't already, check out the free resources that we have at roborman.com. These were all made to address specific pain points in medical practice. Scripting your least favorite conversations, my four favorite documentation templates, the quick and dirty guide to calling consults, and the driveway debrief. You can find them all under the freebies tab on the website, or you can click the link in the show notes to get right to them. All right, back to the show. So you've got that, okay, I'm going to be the organizer and I need your help. Okay, silence, silence. I need to hear your voices. I need your help. Okay. Okay. Sue, I need you at the head of the bed managing the airway. Joe, I need you pushing meds. Fred, I need you getting access. You're signing roles. These are the next steps. Access. If you don't get your IVs, put in IOs. So and so. You're going to be giving these meds. Then you are going to intubate and you're being chest compressed, all of these things. Does anyone else have any other ideas? So you're saying, here are the next steps. And you're basically giving out the tasks to these people so that it's not, are we just going to do everything all at once? It's, here's the sequence. Here's what I need you to be doing. And then at the end, when you're talking about that feedback, does anyone else have any other ideas? # what am I missing?
That is exactly it. I do want to point out, though, there, I think there's a forest and trees issue here. So aiming involves two pieces. One is, what are we trying to achieve in these next few moments? And two is, who's going to do what to get us there?
Okay.
So for example, in this case, we are going to need to manage the airway, do our ABCs, and figure out, are we going to CT, OR, or transfer? To get us there, these are the roles we're going to need. So we need to connect these two pieces so people know why they're doing what they're doing. This helps to frame whether your proposed roles make sense. Because what we really want somebody to say is, actually, I think we're missing getting this patient some emergent blood or whatever the case might be. And we really want those speaking up behaviors, which will only happen if they understand the direction that we're going in a big picture as well.
Name, claim, aim. So the aim, start forest and then funnel down to trees.
Yes.
So if it's in a code, we want to make sure we've got high quality CPR and run this code smoothly. There's the forest. I'm trying to think of what the forest is.
Sure.
Because I'm what? Putting in the trees, because I'm thinking very quickly I'm getting to trees.
And we need to do this fast, right? So if we take too long, people will just start getting to work.
Yeah.
So this has to be fast and efficient, and it's something that we'll need to practice. And yeah, we won't be perfect, but that's okay. So here's a quick stem of a case.
Okay.
All right. They hand you an EKG.
Okay.
Shows an anterior STEMI. You say, all right, where's the patient? They're in triage room. All right. You turn to the unit clerk and you say, can you activate the cath lab? You start walking over to the room. You open the door to the room and there's a tech standing in the room with the patient. The patient is unresponsive. You push the code bell. Three people are right around the corner and they walk in the room. So you have a patient you believe is having a STEMI and they have gone unresponsive and you've got four people in the room. So what are you going to do? What are you going to say in those first moments to get those guys organized? And we're going to do, I'm going to let you run through it. We'll do a little quick coach. Okay.
Okay. So my first move in my mind, just my reflex is check pulse and start CPR. It's a cardiac arrest until proven otherwise. Could be something else, but there's a bigger picture here. And I need 10 seconds so that I'm not the only operator in all of this. And that is such a challenge. I do want to get into this, balancing being a primary operator, especially when you're the only clinician, versus being the leader. So here we've got somebody. Are they on the floor or are they in a chair?
They're in a bed.
Oh, they're on the stretcher.
They're on a stretcher.
Massive. I've got my four people. I just want to pull up name, claim, aim.
This is great because when you're learning something, what you want to do is have a cognitive aid.
Yeah.
Go through some experimental cycles. Try it in a low stakes environment, like live on a podcast.
Yeah, it's hard because I think, okay, I need to pull in this mental model. But I always found these situations really hard.
Yeah.
Anybody listening to this, almost anybody, has had patients arrest in triage. It is a shark show. Let me just slow this down into the 10 seconds. We've got an unresponsive patient. I think it's cardiac arrest. I'm going to get us organized. I need your help. All right.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Jose, I want you to check pulse, start CPR, if no pulse. Aaron, I want you on airway with the bag valve mask. Get it off the wall, attached to oxygen, begin bagging. You over there, because you just started yesterday, don't remember your name. Apologies, bad form. Go to room one, get the defibrillator. When you come in, attach it. And then here I am. We want to do high. So I did my name, I did my claim, and now my aim. This is almost certainly a cardiac arrest. We want to have high quality CPR and get things temporized until we sort out exactly what's happening. We need to get this patient hooked up to the defibrillator as quickly as possible while CPR is continued. Does anyone have any other ideas? I want to tell you that the ACLS algorithm is pushing on my brain so hard to just come out of my mouth. It is really a challenge to be, we're just talking about this. It is really a challenge to be organizing this team while that patient is lying there. That all happened in about 10 seconds. And it's going to, in the long run, it's going to make things way better. So I've organized my CPR. I've organized my ventilation, oxygenation, and I'm getting my defibrillator, my three critical tasks. There's all sorts of stuff needs to happen down the road. So I feel pretty good with naming, claiming, and aiming. I am actually sweating, Juan, like thinking about this.
Thank you so much for working so hard to make this real. Trying this new thing. Yeah.
Coach me up.
Yeah.
Me up.
That's great. So let's dig into the thing that you are finding most difficult, which is I think what I'm hearing is the challenge between all the things that you could be doing and the people you have in front of you and how you're trying to determine the key actions that need to be taken first. Is that kind of what was going through your head?
Yeah, it's when you are a leader and you are only leading, you're on the balcony. When you're an operator, you're on the dance floor. And in this situation, I just wanted to boogie. But really,
okay.
I needed to be in the balcony organizing the line dance happening below me.
So I think what I'm hearing is the tension in you, in just you as, I'm going to use my air quotes again, I want to do something.
Yeah.
And just standing here organizing the team doesn't feel like I'm doing something to help the patient.
Yeah.
Because I have all these skills inside me.
Much of my career was spent in resource-limited places where often I was the only doc. Not always. And sometimes it was a plethora of resources. But you know, worked in some super tiny EDs where it was, if you got one sick patient, the whole thing shut down. So I had that reflex. And what's the coolest, I'm just thinking back earlier, what's the coolest thing you get to do when you're in med students? Hey, get on to CPR. And oh, I love this. I love this. Let's get the quality CPR. And even sometimes you're the code leader. So let me get in there. Just get a little CPR going. Or let me get the ultrasound. Let me get the intubate. It's such a reflex to, all right, how do I sequence my procedures?
Yes.
Because I need to be thinking about the stuff I'm doing. But actually, I have all these other people who can do stuff too. It is a really hard balance.
It's such a hard balance. As I was listening to you, I was thinking, Rob's doing such a great job deciding what the priorities are in this moment. We've got compressions and defibrillation and ventilations. What do we know about CPR? Compressions and defibrillation. Those are the things that matter. You having this framework were able to keep your hands behind your back, put your attention on organizing the team to focus them on the key things. Now, what happens if we don't do this? If we don't do this, people start doing things. People are going to be working on an IV. There's no doubt in my mind. And what is that IV attempt going to do? It is going to block the person who needs to put the defib pads on from accessing the patient. It's not our intention, but a long time can go by between the defib coming into the room and it being applied and used on these patients when we're trying to do ACLS. What I was seeing was a lot of mental energy working on, okay, we need to start this resuscitation and where do we start? And that's a really different question than what is all of ACLS. Same with our pediatric trauma. We've got our first 3 minutes. What do we need to do? And I have found myself not having a structured framework, having a trauma patient arresting in front of me and finding myself doing things like a fast scan, which I know that ABCDE is how you resuscitate a trauma patient. But in the moment, we find ourselves doing things because it feels good to do things. We know how to do things. And somehow we need to value these 10 seconds and our role as an organizer more highly than our role as a compressor, for example. And that's pretty tough to do. Now, when should you do compressions? When you're the only person in the room. But if you're not the only person in the room as the doctor, once you put your hands on that patient, you are going to lose sight of the bigger picture in a way that you don't intend. So I've seen people have different techniques for keeping their hands off of the patient at the beginning of a resuscitation. Did you ever come up with anything as an attending that worked for you?
Let's see. I had a couple things depending on the resources. Sometimes it actually was doing the ultrasound because that was not in a trauma rest is really important. I need to see what's going on with the heart. But a lot of times it just kept me out of doing other things. I would sometimes, some EDs I worked in had a chair, like a rocking chair, and I would sit in that rocking chair and I would call the instructions from that chair to take myself away.
Wow, that is ultra cool, man. That requires some really cool shorts.
I did it. And it was one of those great rocker gliders.
I've never been in a room that had a rocker glider that I was resuscitating in. I'm going to have to try that.
I would sometimes cross my arms. And especially when I was the only doc, I would just get to the head of the bed. And I would stay at the head of the bed. And that was probably the most common thing. Because if intubation needs to happen, I'm going to be the one intubating. But then I can also see what's going on with everyone. And I'm not going to be getting in anybody's way.
Yeah. So being at the head of the bed, that can be a good technique. There is a little bit of a challenge. Very experienced airway managers can bag a patient and do it in their kind of subconscious, right? it can be an automated task to bag a patient every 6 seconds. Anesthesiologists will do that. Oftentimes, new emergency physicians or paramedics, et cetera, when they go into the bagging position, but they're trying to lead the team, will not deliver any breaths. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. It is a place of comfort for us as emergency physicians.
One reason I liked to be there, especially if there was bagging, if it was bagging of an intubated patient or if it was just bag valve mask, and the only thing that I would do there, I would not bag, but I would hold the seal and look up.
Seems great. Yeah.
And yeah, it was this, and if I would give the instructions to the respiratory therapist, or if there's a paramedic, of watch the clock, here's how often to deliver that breath. And I wanted to make sure it was actually happening, because that breath stacking and all this kind of is so easy to do.
Right. That's wonderful, because then you know with confidence that you're getting chest rise, but you're not responsible for thinking about when to deliver the next breath.
Right.
And so that kind of unburdens you from the A. The A, you check it off. You like, we can deal with it because we're supporting the A right now. I like that. In bigger teams, or if you don't feel that you have to be at the head of the bed, other techniques I've seen, some people will not put gloves on for leading a team. And once they've put their gloves on, it's a symbol to them that they're no longer in that kind of active team organization mode. And that keeps them back from the patient. We have a podium nurse situation in our department. So we have a podium at the foot of the bed that the documenting nurse uses. If you stand next to the podium, it helps you have great communication with the nurse kind of logistics documenter. And that's really a helpful place too.
We've been talking about this a lot, and I want to make sure that we have squeezed every ounce of juice out of this question of the balance between leadership and getting your hands dirty. Because the chances are you are going to be, as the doctor, you are going to be the one who's able to and has to put in the chest tube, has to do this procedure or that procedure. Not all the procedures, but definitely some of the critical procedures.
Right.
And let's just acknowledge, it's tricky. How do you do it well?
You can think of distributing the decision-making across time and space to somebody else as your kind of surrogate leader when you're going to be tied up. It might look something like this. All right, Marquez, I'm going to be intubating. And during that time, I'm going to need you to continue with ACLS. Or actually, one that happened to me recently, the procedure of talking to the family. So I'm in the room. There's a code happening. I'm running the code. It's a child and the family is on the phone. And I feel this really strong obligation to give them an update. They're driving it. So explicitly transferring, okay, Mike, I'm going to be on the phone. I want you to keep doing ACLS. And if there's anything that you have questions about, interrupt me. But for now, just do epi, fluids, etc. And so a real explicit transfer of that authority during the moments when you're incapacitated. And incapacitated is any procedure. So you might be the best intubator in the world. We have tons of research from the anesthesia world that you completely lose sight of what's happening with the oxygen, with the blood pressure. And you all know this. You look up after your intubation and it's like you've emerged from a dream state. You don't know how much time has gone by. You don't know what's happening. And the room could literally be on fire. We used to run a fire in the OR simulation. And one time I was the participant and I was intubating the patient when the fire broke out. And I looked up afterwards and the room was on fire and I had no idea about it. So your cognitive load is completely dedicated. It should be, and it needs to be completely dedicated to doing your task as well as possible. And that can only happen if you explicitly offload what might happen while you're tied up to somebody else. So that's the best way of doing it. Now, in extremely small teams, that's really hard, right? And it might just be like, hey, I'm going to be intubating for a few minutes. Keep doing what you're doing. Let me know if you need anything. But most of our medical response teams are too big rather than too small. And there's somebody there who you can offload that situational awareness to and decision-making. So let me give you an example of it during an intubation. What I do is generally I will tell the podium nurse or somebody else, if the SAT gets below 92, you need to stop me and I need to change what I'm doing. For example, it could be 80, depending on the situation, but I'm moving decision-making to somebody else. I'm making the decision, but I'm moving the action to them, and they can take that action when the time comes and keep paying attention to the situation.
We are talking about name, claim, aim in a linear way. And would it be okay if I use the graphic that you sent me for the show notes for this episode?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. But we're talking about this as if it's linear, but it's a cycle. And you go name, claim, aim, and then you rename and re-aim. And how do you know if you need to do that, when it's time to do that, and then how do you do that?
I think that in many situations, like your routine code situations, there's definitely a flow. Let's say most codes, it takes about 6 minutes, two defibs, you've established your airway. That whole piece takes 5 or 6 minutes. The team has arrived and there's a little lull in the action. You've done the first task. So that is, there's often a sense that we've done the first round. We aimed to do these first things. If we go back to the cardiac arrest, we aimed to start compressions, defibrillate, and then you might rename. Okay, so we've started compressions. We've done our first round of defibrillations. We're still in VFib. Now our next jobs are going to be continue compressions. In 2 minutes, we'll give our next shock and let's establish an IV. And do we need to establish an airway? So that would be a natural place. Another time would be often in our emergencies, there's like another physician or another team leader that will show up. So maybe you have a floor code and the ICU doc shows up. We need to reestablish actually the claim as well. Okay, guys, we've gotten through our first round of CPR. We've done two defibrillations and one of epi. Dr. Aziz is here from the ICU. Let's plan the next part of this resuscitation. The patient is still in VFib. I'm thinking I'll stay as team leader. Will you help with central line, Dr. Aziz? I also think the next things we need to do are consider ECMO, et cetera. So I find that it's relatively natural when you've gotten through your first kind of round of activities or the next group of people has come in. That's a good time to do it. But other good times are it's just too loud in the room. We need to bring the tone, the anxiety, the tone, and the stress level. One of the real benefits to name, claim, aim is it reduces the anxiety in the room because people know what the problem is, they know what the structure of the team is, and they don't have to worry about the social dynamics or asking so many questions about what's actually happening.
Someone is listening to this and they're thinking, oh, this sounds great, but how do I take this and build it into my everyday work so that I have it available when the crisis happens?
Well, I think this is a real key part of name, claim, aim in itself. And I'd like to talk about how name, claim, aim is going to help our teams be more successful than the way we've been trying to teach teaming so far, as well as how you can build it into your own everyday practice. Number one, for the last 30 years, we've been teaching crisis resource management principles, so-called CRM principles, which are really important and foundational to the practice of teams. And David Gaba and his team at Stanford and Palo Alto VA Medical Center transformed teamwork in healthcare with their work. The challenge with CRM is it's 11 principles. It's really hard to know how to do them at the dose of training we get. So you can put together great training programs on cross-monitoring, maintaining situational awareness, for example, one of the key CRM principles. Traditionally, however, we've been teaching it by here's all of CRM, go practice all of CRM. I think it's been less effective than we wish it would be. And let's just make a sports team metaphor, right? You are coaching, I think you are a lacrosse, you're a lacrosse referee.
Wow, what a memory. Yes, yeah, in fact, my first, the games start next week. I have been studying up on my rules changes. There's always lots of rule changes. Oh, yes. Super stoked for the season.
I know nothing about lacrosse, so this might come out totally crazy, but I imagine that you could play zone or man-to-man defense.
You can do that.
And if you had a man-to-man defense team and you wanted to switch to zone, you wouldn't give people a two-hour lecture on zone and then go play a game and then debrief the game. You would do focused drills on different situations and specific skills of how do you cover in zone in different situations. Then you would put it together in small pieces of mock games, and then you would bring it to a full game. Where I'm going with this is we need to do two things. Number one, we need to use name, claim, aim as a simplified distillation of the CRM principles. And number two, we need to find small focused activities where we can start to rehearse this and then ramp up the difficulty over time, ramp up the complexity, and then start to try to use it. And even if it's just one piece of it in our crises. And so I would propose that we start with naming the situation, just saying what's happening, and doing that in kind of low stakes situations. I actually had a patient recently where this really came in handy. And I had a patient who was septic. It was routine sepsis. People were doing the things in the room and we were starting some pressors and some antibiotics. And I just said, so just clarifying, this is sepsis. And the nurse said, oh, I need to get cultures before the antibiotics. And just saying what was happening helped the team recognize what they were doing and coordinate. And so I would start with just naming the situation in my routine moments. You're in the room with the nurse and the patient, and you're discharging them with a knee injury, and you just say you have some type of a knee injury. X-rays are good. I'm worried that it's an important internal derangement. I'm referring you for orthopedics next week. Just focus on actually explicitly saying the situation. We make a lot of assumptions about people understanding what we understand about a situation that actually lead to a lot of confusion. So I would start there in my everyday practice as frequently as possible, just naming the situation. And then I would ramp up the difficulty there.
What's that look like?
When you find yourself walking out of the room, realizing, oh, I didn't say what the situation was. It's a sign that this was a little bit too high cognitive load for you to remember. So you got to walk back in the room and go say it. You'll find that you can do that task in isolation in more and more difficult situations.
So we're incrementalizing the practice of this to make it routine. So the naming, great. I think low-hanging fruit to start in intentional practice. What about claiming?
I was actually curious. You said claiming went pretty easy for you. And my experience is actually that's the hardest thing for people to do. It's very awkward in healthcare to put your hand up and say, I'm the leader. I think that in the end, we want this whole thing to be an action-linked phrase where, you know, instead of it being three different items, name, claim, aim is one thing that we do as a brain. Mm. Claim is usually the piece that people do last. If I had my way, what I would do is I would have simulation training where all we're doing is getting case stems. We're in a team, we're doing case stems, and we're doing name, claim, aim. Mm-hmm. So that's how we teach it in our teaming courses now with anesthesia, is we do rapid cycle deliberate practice of name, claim, aiming, starting with just standing in a room with no fidelity and just a monitor and a rhythm and just practicing saying the words. That's another way of starting the rehearsal and then trying to put those in isolated situations. If we're going to gather a new skill and really have access to it in a crisis, we need to do deliberate practice, right? And deliberate practice is going to involve finding situations where we can do it, stretching ourselves, making those situations more difficult over time, and getting some form of feedback, either from ourselves or from a coach or educator or facilitator.
So you're practicing that framework for the crisis, just like you're using your new intubation tool on the very easy intubation, right? So you get used to that. So the patient, okay, we have a high-speed motor vehicle crash coming in, signs of chest trauma. We may end up needing to do chest tube, thoracotomy, airway. I'm going to get us organized. Okay. your team is used to getting organized before those events. So you're going to be organizing. You just do that. But getting that scripting ready, I'm going to get us organized, okay? I need to hear voices, okay? It's, oh, thanks, Dad. But it's like, hey, I'm just getting used to the scripting in case we just be transparent about it. And then you assign the roles, and our job when this patient is going to come in is getting into our positions and assessing for these injuries. What am I missing?
So I love the idea of using it in your briefing or your huddle. And you're right. That's such a low stakes moment where we're used to having some form of organizing conversation. And if we can practice our script then. And what was going through my mind then is the challenge of valuing that organization time when the patient's in front of us. So we value it before the patient has shown up, but do we value it enough when the patient has already shown up? And that is, I think, at the core of the tension is, can we bring ourselves to value that taking 10 seconds, as some of my colleagues at Mass General say, is let's take 10 seconds for the next 10 minutes. We have this idea that time is linear and every second is worth the same amount. And I'm going to make a proposal that time is not linear and these 10 seconds of organization are worth so much more than the next 3 minutes of disorganization would be. Let's not believe that every second is worth the same. So when things are starting to get chaotic, or they are chaotic by their very nature, we need to find it in ourselves to value the organization moment.
We've been talking about how this moves things forward, but we've also mentioned, sort of interwoven in this, that this is not necessarily the norm. You want to get this right. What is the consequence of not getting this right?
That's a key point. This is for the benefit of our patients. It's also for the benefit of us as clinicians. So let's think together. What are the risks if we don't organize our teams and we don't have resuscitations that feel good? I like to classify them in three ways. One is, what is the risk to the patient and family? What is the risk to the provider and team? And what is the risk to the organization? What do you think about risks to patient and family?
Without this organization, the management becomes shambolic, as in it is a shambles. Eventually, it will coalesce into some form, but it is suboptimal.
There
may be an outcome for that family which reverberates for the rest of their lives. If not, it is the end of life for that person just by spending a few seconds doing this. For the clinician, the risk is trauma. It is trauma that you carry with you for a long time. As you're saying, how do you want to feel after this? And it's, oh man, it was just a sham. It just didn't go well. And I didn't do the best job. And why do these patients always do so poorly? And then your inner critical voice, and that can stay with you. And then for the organization, it's pure risk.
What I would add to that is the patient and family trust for the clinical team, which can follow them on this journey. And we really want them to feel that things were done effectively for their loved one, and trauma for ourselves, but also for our colleagues. Mm. Our teams can either be growing in strength or they can be withering. There's no in between, right? And so each event is a check mark in a column of building or decaying in our teams. Mm. And if these events add up over time to being more and more decaying, then our culture of our departments starts to spin out of control. And in our organization, it's all risk. It's risk. It's legal risk. We face that legal risk as well, of course, just to add to our trauma. And also PR risk. Who goes to the newspaper is people who don't trust that the organization was there for their loved ones. There are just so many reasons to prioritize this and to commit to doing our best. At the same time, we need to recognize that, you know, some of us have developed habits over decades. And when we get into these crises, we're really falling on our habits, and it's going to take us time to rebuild those habits.
If you can organize your team, it doesn't matter how much medicine you know or don't know, there is no way that you won't feel more confident.
Yeah. And team success is an emergent property. You cannot be at your best on a certain day. And if you have a team around you, they'll lift you up. And likewise, you can do that for your team members. And a team is not the sum of its parts. It's really so much more than that. Its success exists between people. And the goal of Name, Claim, Aim is to have that active building, that active participation. Don't let people freeload and just do the task that's easy in front of them, but have them be active participants in building that team with you. Although it feels like the weight is on our shoulders, as soon as we start the process, it's a process about joining people together, and they will help move it forward.
Lon Setnick, it is always a treat. Thank you so much for your time, your erudite explanations, your kindness during the coaching of my resuscitation, and just for your time. Really appreciate it.
Rob, this was so much fun. And I really appreciate actually you leaning into the activities, because I think the struggle, the sweat is so real. And I actually think that's really important, because if I come on here and tell people to do this thing and they don't get to see that it's going to be hard, then they might just try it and it doesn't work the first time and they give up on it. Your willingness to go on your own show and be humble and try new things, I'm just processing how important that is for moving these conversations forward. So thanks for the opportunity and great to talk to you again.
Bye-bye. And that is it for today. And you know what? If you love medicine, but you find the job itself leaves a lot to be desired, I work with docs in your shoes who feel the same way and help them extend their careers and have fun doing it. Can you imagine driving to your next shift with a feeling of stoke and excitement? And then when you leave for the day, you think to yourself, hey, that was pretty damn great. We can help get you there. And you can reach out to me at roborman.com. Until the next time, my friends, be well and keep on rocking.